grass. It was me.
You are pretty hot.
You can't be joking right now. It's getting worse. We sat next to each other, looking out at what was left of Greenbrier. But we weren't really looking at Greenbrier. We were looking at the power of the other fire. Just like my mom. She sounded bitter. Fire was the trademark of a cataclyst, and Seraphine's fire had burnt every inch of these fields the night of Lena's birthday. Now Lena was starting fires unintentionally. My stomach tightened.
The grass will grow back, too.
What if I don't want it to? She said softly, strangely, as she let another handful of charred grass fall through her fingers.
What?
Why should it? Because life goes on, El. The birds do their thing, and the bees do theirs. Seeds get scattered, and everything grows back. Then it all gets burnt again, if you're lucky enough to be around me. There was no point arguing with Lena when she was in one of these moods. A lifetime with Amma going dark had taught me that. Sometimes it does. She pulled her knees up and rested her chin on them. Her shape cast a shadow much larger than she actually was. But I'm still lucky. I moved my leg until it caught the light, throwing a long line of my shadow into hers. We sat like that, side by side, with only our shadows touching, until the sun went down and they stretched toward the black trees and disappeared into dusk. We listened to the cicadas in silence and tried not to think until the rain started falling again. May 1st. Falling. In the next few weeks, I successfully convinced Lena to leave the house with me a total of 3 times. Once to the movies with Link, my best friend since second grade, where even her signature combination of popcorn and milk duds didn't cheer her up. Once to my house to eat Amma's molasses cookies and watch a zombie marathon, my version of a dream date. It wasn't. And once for a walk along the Santee, where we ended up turning around after 10 minutes with 60 bug bites between us. Wherever she was, she didn't want to be. Today was different. She had finally found somewhere she was comfortable, even if it was the last place I expected. I walked in her room to find her lying sprawled across the ceiling, arms flung across the plaster, her hair spread out like a black fan around her head.
Since when can you do that?
I was used to Lena's powers by now, but since her 16th birthday, they seemed to be getting stronger and wilder, as if she was awkwardly growing into herself as a caster. With every day, Lena, the caster girl, was more unpredictable, stretching her powers to see what she could do. As it turned out, what she could do these days was cause all kinds of trouble. Like the time Link and I were driving to school in the beater, and one of his songs came on the radio as if the station was playing it. Link was so shocked he'd swerved a good 2 feet into Mrs. Asher's front hedge. An accident, Lena said with a crooked smile. One of Link's songs was stuck in my head. Nobody had ever gotten one of Link's songs stuck in their head. But Link had believed her, which made his ego even more unbearable.
What can I say? I have that effect on the ladies. This voice is as smooth as butter.
A week after that, Link and I had been walking down the hall, and Lena came up and gave me a big hug, right as the bell was ringing. I figured she had finally decided to come back to school, but she wasn't actually there at all. It was some kind of projection, or whatever the caster word was for making your boyfriend look like an idiot. Link thought I was trying to hug him, so he called me Lover Boy for days. I missed you. Is that such a crime? Lena thought it was funny,
but I was starting to wish Grandma would step in and ground her, or whatever it was you did to a natural who was up to no good.
Don't be a baby. I said I was sorry, didn't I? You're as big a menace as Link in fifth grade, the year he sucked all the juice out of my mom's tomatoes with a straw. It won't happen again, I swear.
That's what Link said back then.
But he stopped, right?
Yeah, when we stopped growing tomatoes.
Come down. I like it better up here. I grabbed her hand. A current crept through my arm, but I didn't let go, pulling her down onto the bed next to me.
Ouch.
She was laughing. I could see her shoulder shudder even though her back was to me. Or maybe she wasn't laughing but crying, which was rare these days. The crying had mostly stopped and had been replaced by something worse. Nothing. Nothing was deceptive. Nothing was much harder to describe or fix or stop.
Do you want to talk about it, Elle? About what?
I pulled her closer, resting my head on hers. The shaking slowed, and I held her as tight as I could, like she was still on the ceiling, and I was the one hanging on.
Nothing.
I shouldn't have complained about the ceiling. There were crazier places you could hang out, like where we were now. I have a bad feeling about this. I was sweating, but I couldn't wipe my face. I needed my hands to stay right where they were.
That's weird, Lena smiled down at me, because I have a very good feeling about it.
Her hair was blowing in a breeze, though I wasn't sure which kind.
Besides, we're almost there. You realize this is insane, right? If a cop drives by, we're gonna get arrested or sent to Blue Horizons to visit my dad.
It's not crazy, it's romantic. Couples come here all the time.
When people go to the water tower, Elle, they aren't talking about the top of the water tower, which is where we would be in a minute. Just the two of us, a wobbly iron ladder about 100 feet above the ground, and a bright blue Carolina sky.
I tried not to look down. Lena had talked me into climbing to the top. There was something about the excitement in her voice that made me go along with it, as if something so stupid might be able to make her feel the way she did the last time we were here, smiling, happy, in a red sweater. I remembered because there was a piece of red yarn hanging from her charm necklace. She must have remembered, too. So here we were, stuck on a ladder, looking up so we didn't look down. Once we reached the top and I looked out at the view, I understood. Lena was right. It was better up here. Everything was so far away that it didn't even matter. I let my legs dangle over the edge. My mom used to collect pictures of old water towers.
Yeah?
Like the sisters collect spoons. Only for my mom, it was water towers and postcards from the World's Fair.
I thought all water towers looked like this one, like a big white spider.
Somewhere in Illinois, there's one shaped like a ketchup bottle.
She laughed.
And there's one that looks like a little house, this high off the ground.
We should live there. I'd go up once and never come back down.
She lay back on the warm white paint.
I guess in Gatlin it should be a peach, a big old Gatlin peach.
I leaned back next to her.
They already have one, but it's not in Gatlin. It's over in Gaffney. Guess they thought of it first.
What about a pie? We could paint this tank to look like one of Amma's pies. She'd like that.
Haven't seen one of those, but my mom had a picture of one shaped like a corn cob.
I'd still rather have the house.
Lena stared up at the sky, where there wasn't a cloud in sight.
I'd take the corn cob or the ketchup, if you were there.
She reached for my hand and we stayed like that, at the edge of Somerville's plain white water tower, looking out at Gatlin County as if it was a tiny toy land full of tiny toy people, as small as the cardboard village my mom used to keep under our Christmas tree. How could people that small have any problems at all?
Hey, I brought you something.
I watched as she sat up, looking at me like a little kid.
What is it?
I looked over the edge of the water tower.
Maybe we should wait until we can't fall to our deaths.
We're not going to die. Don't be such a chicken. I reached into my back pocket. It wasn't anything special, but I'd had it for a while now, and I was hoping it might help her find her way back to herself. I pulled out a mini Sharpie with a key ring on it.
See? It fits on your necklace like this.
Trying not to fall, I reached for Lena's necklace, the one she never took off. A tangle of charms, each one meant something to her. The flattened penny from the machine at the Cineplex, where we had our first date. A silver moon Macon had given her the night of the winter formal. The button from the vest she was wearing the night in the rain. They were Lena's memories, and she carried them with her as if she might lose them without proof of those few perfect moments of happiness. I snapped the Sharpie onto the chain.
Now you can write wherever you are.
Even on ceilings? She looked at me and smiled, a little crooked, a little sad.
Even on water towers.
I love it.
She spoke quietly, pulling the cap off the Sharpie. Before I knew it, she was drawing a heart. Black ink on white paint, a heart, hidden at the top of the Somerville Water Tower. I was happy for a second. Then I felt like I was falling all the way down. Because she wasn't thinking about us. She was thinking about her next birthday, the 17th moon. She was already counting down. In the center of the heart, she didn't write our names. She wrote a number. May 16th. The call. I didn't ask her about what she'd written on the water tower, but I didn't forget it. How could I when all we had done for the past year was count down to the inevitable? When I finally asked why she'd written it or what she was counting down to, she wouldn't say, and I had the feeling she really didn't know, which was even worse than knowing. It had been 2 weeks since then, and as far as I could tell, Lena still hadn't written anything in her notebook. She was wearing the little Sharpie on her necklace, but it looked as new as the day I bought it at the Stop and Steal. It was weird not to see her writing, scribbling on her hands or her worn-out Converse, which she didn't wear much these days. She had started wearing her thrashed black boots instead. Her hair was different, too, almost always tied back as if she thought she could yank the magic right out of it. We were sitting on the top step of my porch, the same place we had been sitting when Lena first told me she was a caster, a secret she had never shared with a mortal before. I was pretending to read Jekyll and Hyde. Lena was staring down at the blank pages of her spiral notebook, as if the thin blue lines held the answer to all her problems. When I wasn't watching Lena, I was staring down my street. My dad was coming home today. Mama and I had visited him on family day every week since my aunt checked him in to Blue Horizons. Even though he wasn't back to his old self, I had to admit he was acting almost like a regular person again, but I was still nervous.
They're here!
The screen door slammed behind me. Mama was standing on the porch in her tulle apron, the kind she preferred over a traditional one, especially on days like this. She was holding the gold charm around her neck, rubbing it between her fingers. I looked down the street, but the only thing I saw was Billy Watson riding his bike. Lena leaned forward to get a better look.
I don't see a car.
I didn't either, but I knew I would in about 5 seconds, Amma was proud, particularly when it came to her abilities as a seer. She wouldn't say they were here unless she knew they were coming.
"It'll be here."
Sure enough, my aunt's white Cadillac made the right onto Cotton Bend. Aunt Caroline had the window rolled down, what she liked to call 360 air conditioning, and I could see her waving from down the block. I stood up as Amma elbowed her way past me.
"Come on now, your daddy deserves a proper homecoming."
That was code for, "Get your butt down to the curb, Ethan Waite." I took a deep breath.
"Are you okay?"
Lena's hazel eyes caught the sun.
"Yeah,"
I lied. She must have known, but she didn't say a word. I took her hand. It was cold, the way she always was now, and the current of electricity felt more like the sting of frostbite.
"Mitchell, wait! Don't tell me you've been eating anybody's pie but mine, 'cause you look like you fell into the cookie jar and couldn't find your way back out."
My dad gave her a knowing look. Amma had raised him, and he knew her teasing held as much love as any hug. I stood there while Amma fussed over him as if he was 10 years old. She and my aunt were chattering away like the three of them had just come home from the market. My dad smiled at me weakly. It was the same smile he gave me when we visited Blue Horizons. It said, "I'm not crazy anymore. Just ashamed." He was wearing his old Duke t-shirt and jeans, and somehow he looked younger than I remembered, except for the crinkling lines around his eyes, which deepened as he pulled me in for an awkward hug.
"How you doing?"
My voice caught in my throat for a second, and I coughed.
"Good."
He looked over at Lena.
"Nice to see you again, Lena. I was sorry to hear about your uncle."
Those were hard-bred southern manners for you. He had to acknowledge Macon's passing, even in a moment as awkward as this one. Lena tried to smile, but she only managed to look as uncomfortable as I felt.
"Thank you, sir." "Ethan, come on over here and give your favorite aunt a hug."
Aunt Caroline held out her hands. I wanted to throw my arms around her and let her squeeze the knot right out of my chest.
"Let's go on inside."
Amma waved at my dad from the top of the porch.
"I made a Coca-Cola cake and fried chicken. If we don't get in there soon, that chicken'll have a mind to find its way home."
Aunt Caroline looped her arm through my dad's and led him up the stairs. She had the same brown hair and small frame as my mom, and for a second it felt like my parents were home again, walking through the old screen door of Waite's Landing.
"I have to get home."
Lena was clutching her notebook against her chest like a shield.
"You don't have to go. Come in."
"Please." I wasn't offering to be polite. I didn't want to go in there alone. A few months ago, Lena would have known that. But I guess today her mind was somewhere else, because she didn't.
"You should spend some time with your family."
She stood up on her toes and kissed me, her lips barely touching my cheek. She was halfway to the car before I could argue. I watched Larkin's fastback disappear down my street. Lena didn't drive the hearse anymore. As far as I knew, she hadn't even looked at it since Macon died. Uncle Barkley had parked it behind the old barn and thrown a tarp over it. Instead, she was driving Larkin's car, all black and chrome. Link had foamed at the mouth the first time he saw it.
"Do you know how many chicks I could pull with that ride?"
After her cousin had betrayed her whole family, I didn't understand why Lena would want to drive his car. When I had asked her, she'd shrugged and said, "He won't be needing it anymore." Maybe Lena thought she was punishing Larkin by driving it. He had contributed to Macon's death, something she would never forgive. I watched the car turn the corner, wishing I could disappear along with it. By the time I made it to the kitchen, there was already chicory coffee brewing, and trouble. Amma was on the phone, pacing in front of the sink, and every minute or two she would cover the receiver with her hand and report the conversation on the other end to Aunt Caroline.
"They haven't seen her since yesterday."
Amma put the phone back to her ear.
"You should make Aunt Mercy a toddy and put her to bed until we find her."
"Find who?" I looked at my dad, and he shrugged. Aunt Caroline pulled me over to the sink and whispered the way Southern ladies do when something is too awful to say out loud.
"Lucille Ball, she's missing."
Lucille Ball was Aunt Mercy's Siamese cat, who spent most of her time running around my great-aunt's front yard on a leash attached to a clothesline, an activity the sisters referred to as exercising.
"What do you mean?"
Amma covered the receiver with her hand again, narrowing her eyes and setting her jaw. The look.
"Seems somebody put the idea in your aunt's head that cats don't need to be tied up because they always come back home. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?"
It wasn't a question. We both knew I was the one who had been saying it for years.
"But cats aren't supposed to be on leashes."
I tried to defend myself, but it was too late. Amma glared at me and turned to Aunt Caroline.
"Seems Aunt Mercy's been waiting, sitting on the porch, staring at an empty leash hanging on the clothesline."
She took her hand off the receiver.
"You need to get her in the house and put her feet up. If she gets lightheaded, boil some dandelion."
I slunk out of the kitchen before Amma's eyes got any narrower. Great. My 100-year-old aunt's cat was gone, and it was my fault. I'd have to call Link and see if he'd drive around town with me and look for Lucille. Maybe Link's demo tapes would scare her out of hiding.
"Ethan?"
My dad was standing in the hall right outside of the kitchen door.
"Can I talk to you for a second?"
I had been dreading this, the part where he apologized for everything and tried to explain why he had ignored me for almost a year.
"Yeah, sure."
But I didn't know if I wanted to hear it. I wasn't really angry anymore. When I almost lost Lena, there was a part of me that understood why my dad had come completely unhinged. I couldn't imagine my life without Lena. And my dad had loved my mom for more than 18 years. I felt sorry for him now, but it still hurt. My dad ran his hand through his hair and edged closer to me.
"I wanted to tell you how sorry I am."
He paused, staring down at his feet.
"I don't know what happened. One day I was in there riding, and the next day all I could do was think about your mom. Sit in her chair, smell her books, imagine her reading over my shoulder."
He studied his hands as if he was talking to them instead of me. Maybe that was a trick they taught you at Blue Horizons.
"It was the only place I felt close to her. I couldn't let her go."
He looked up at the old plaster ceiling, and a tear escaped from the corner of his eye, running slowly down the side of his face. My dad had lost the love of his life, and he had come unraveled like an old sweater. I'd watched, but I hadn't done anything about it. Maybe he wasn't the only one to blame. I knew I was supposed to smile now, but I didn't feel like it.
"I get it, Dad. I wish you'd said something. I missed her too, you know?"
His voice was quiet when he finally spoke.
"I didn't know what to say."
"It's okay." I didn't know if I meant it yet, but I could see relief spread across his face. He reached around and hugged me, squeezing my back with his fists for a second.
"I'm here now. Do you want to talk about it?"
"About what?"
"Things you need to know when you have a girlfriend."
There was nothing I wanted to talk about less.
"Dad, we don't have to."
"I have a lot of experience, you know. Your mother taught me a thing or two about women over the years."
I started planning my escape route. If you ever want to talk about, you know, I could hurl myself through the study window and squeeze between the hedge and the house. Feelings. I almost laughed in his face. What?
Amma says Lena's having a hard time with her uncle's passing. She's not acting like herself.
Lying on the ceiling, refusing to go to school, not opening up to me, climbing water towers.
No, she's all right. Well, women are a different species.
I nodded and tried not to look him in the eye. He had no idea how right he was.
As much as I loved your mother, half the time I couldn't have told you what was going on in her head.
Relationships are complicated. You know you can ask me anything. What could I ask? What do you do when your heart almost stops beating every time you kiss? Are there times when you should and shouldn't read each other's minds? What are the early warning signs that your girlfriend is being claimed for all time by good or evil? He squeezed my shoulder one last time. I was still trying to put together a sentence when he let go. He was staring down the hall in the direction of the study. The framed portrait of Ethan Carter Waite was hanging in the hallway. I still wasn't used to seeing it, even though I was the one who had hung it there the day after Macon's funeral. It had been hidden under a sheet my whole life, which seemed wrong. Ethan Carter Waite had walked away from a war he didn't believe in and died trying to protect the Castor girl he loved. So I had found a nail and hung the painting. It felt right. After that, I went into my dad's study and picked up the sheets of paper strewn all over the room. I looked at the scribbles and circles one last time, the evidence of how deep love can run and how long loss can last. Then I cleaned up and threw the pages away. That felt right, too. My dad walked over to the painting, studying it as if he was seeing it for the first time.
I haven't seen this guy in a long time.
I was so relieved we had moved on to a new subject, the words came tumbling out. I hung it up, I hope it's okay, but it seemed like it belonged out here, instead of under some old sheet. For a minute, my dad stared up at the portrait of the boy in the Confederate uniform, who didn't look much older than me.
This painting always had a sheet over it when I was a kid. My grandparents never said much about it, but they weren't about to hang a deserter on the wall. After I inherited this place, I found it covered up in the attic and brought it down to the study.
Why didn't you hang it up? I never imagined that my dad had stared at the same hidden outline when he was a kid.
I don't know. Your mother wanted me to. She loved his story, the way he walked away from the war, even though it ended up costing him his life. I meant to hang it. I was just so used to seeing it covered up. Before I got around to it, your mom died.
He ran his hand along the bottom of the carved frame.
You know, you were named after him.
I know. My dad looked at me as if he was looking at me for the first time, too.
She was crazy about that painting. I'm glad you hung it up. It's where he belongs.
I didn't escape the fried chicken or Amma's guilt trip. So after dinner, I drove around the sister's neighborhood with Link looking for Lucille. Link called her name between bites of a chicken leg wrapped in an oily paper towel. Every time he ran his hand over his spiky blonde hair, the shine got shinier from all the grease.
You should have brought more fried chicken along. Cats dig chicken. They eat birds in the wild.
Link was driving slower than usual so I could keep an eye out for Lucille while he beat time to Love Biscuit, his band's terrible new song, on the steering wheel.
Then what, you'd drive around while I hung out the window with a chicken leg in my hand?
Link was so transparent.
You just want more of Amma's chicken. You know it. And Coca-Cola cake.
He hung his drumstick bone out the window.
Here, kitty kitty.
I scanned the sidewalk, looking for a Siamese cat, but something else caught my eye. A crescent moon. It was on a license plate stuck between a bumper sticker of the Stars and Bars, the Confederate flag, and one for Bubba's truck and trailer. The same old South Carolina plates with the state symbol I had seen 1,000 times, only I'd never thought about it before. A blue palmetto and a crescent moon, maybe a castor moon. The castors really had been here a long time.
Cat's stupider than I thought, if he doesn't know about Amma's fried chicken.
She. Lucille Ball's a girl.
It's a cat.
Link swerved and we turned the corner onto Main. Boo Radley was sitting on the curb, watching the beater roll by. His tail thumped, one lonely thump of recognition, as we disappeared down the road. The loneliest dog in town. At the sight of Boo, Link cleared his throat.
Speaking of girls, how are things with Lena?
He hadn't seen much of her, though he'd seen more than most people had. Lena spent most of her time at Ravenwood under the watchful eyes of Grandma and Aunt Dell, or hiding from their watchful eyes, depending on the day. She's dealing. It wasn't a lie, exactly.
Is she? I mean, she seems kind of different, even for Lena.
Link was one of the few people in town who knew Lena's secret.
Her uncle died. That kind of thing changes you?
Link should have known that better than anyone. He'd watched me try to make sense of my mother's death, and then a world without her in it. He knew it was impossible.
Yeah, but she hardly talks, and she's wearing his clothes. Don't you think that's sort of weird?
She's fine.
If you say so, man.
Just drive. We have to find Lucille. I looked out the window at the empty street.
Stupid cat.
Link shrugged and cranked up the volume. His band, the Holy Rollers, shuddered through the speakers. The girl's gone away. Getting dumped was the theme of every song Link wrote. It was his way of dealing. I still hadn't figured out mine. We never found Lucille, and I never got the conversation with Link or my dad out of my mind. My house was quiet, which isn't what you want a house to be if you're trying to run away from your thoughts. The window in my room was open, but the air was as hot and stagnant as everything else today. Link was right. Lena was acting strange. But it had only been a few months. She'd snap out of it, and things would be the way they were before. I dug through the piles of books and papers on my desk, looking for A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, my go-to book for taking my mind off things. Under a stack of old Sandman comics, I found something else. It was a package wrapped in Marion's signature brown paper and tied with string, but it didn't have Gatlin County Library stamped on it. Marion was my mother's oldest friend and the Gatlin County head librarian. She was also a keeper in the Castor world, a mortal who guarded Castor secrets and history, and in Marion's case, the Lunae Libri, a Castor library filled with secrets of its own. She had given me the package after Macon died, but I had forgotten all about it. It was his journal, and she thought Lena would want to have it. Marion was wrong. Lena didn't want to see it or touch it. She wouldn't even let it into Ravenwood.
You keep it, she had said. I don't think I could bear to see his handwriting.
It had been collecting dust on my desk ever since. I turned it over in my hands. It was heavy, almost too heavy to be a book. I wondered what it looked like. It was probably old, made of cracked leather. I untied the string and unwrapped it. I wasn't going to read it, just look at it. But when I pulled the paper away, I realized it wasn't a book. It was a black wooden box, intricately carved with strange Castor symbols.
I ran my hand over the top, wondering what he wrote about. I couldn't imagine him writing poetry like Lena. It was probably full of horticultural notes. I opened the lid carefully. I wanted to see something Macon had touched every day, something that was important to him. The lining was black satin, and the pages inside were unbound and yellowed, written in Macon's fading, spidery script. I touched a page with a single finger. The sky began to spin, and I felt myself pitching forward. The floor rushed up to meet me, but as I hit the ground, I fell through it and found myself in a cloud of smoke.
Fires burned along the river, the only traces of the plantations that had stood there just hours ago. Greenbrier was already engulfed in flames. Ravenwood would be next. The Union soldiers must have been taking a break, drunk from their victory and the liquor they had pillaged from the wealthiest homes in Gatlin. Abraham didn't have much time. The soldiers were coming, and he was going to have to kill them. It was the only way to save Ravenwood. The mortals didn't stand a chance against him, even if they were soldiers. They were no match for an incubus. And if his brother, Jonah, ever came back from the tunnels, the soldiers would have two of them to contend with. The guns were Abraham's only concern. Even though mortal weapons couldn't kill his kind, the bullets would weaken him, which might give the soldiers the time they needed to set fire to Ravenwood. Abraham needed to feed, and even through the smoke, he could smell the desperation and fear of a mortal nearby. Fear would make him strong. It provided more power and sustenance than memories or dreams. Abraham traveled toward the scent, but when he materialized in the woods beyond Greenbrier, he knew he was too late. The scent was faint. In the distance, he could see Genevieve Duquesne hunched over a body in the mud. Ivy, Greenbrier's cook, was standing behind Genevieve, clutching something against her chest. The old woman saw Abraham and rushed toward him.
"Mr. Ravenwood, thank the Lord."
She lowered her voice.
"You have to take this. Put it somewhere safe till I can come for it."
Pulling a heavy black book from the folds of her apron, she thrust it into Abraham's hands. As soon as he touched it, Abraham could feel its power. The book was alive, pulsating against his palms as if it had a heartbeat. He could almost hear it whispering to him, beckoning him to take it, to open it, and release whatever was hiding inside. There were no words on its cover, only a single crescent moon. Abraham ran his fingers over the edges. Ivy was still talking, mistaking Abraham's silence for hesitation.
"Please, Mr. Ravenwood, I got no one else to give it to, and I can't leave it with Miss Genevieve, not now."
Genevieve raised her head as if she could hear them through the rain and the roar of the flames. The moment Genevieve turned toward them, Abraham understood. He could see her yellow eyes glowing in the darkness, the eyes of a dark caster. In that moment, he also understood what he was holding. The Book of Moons. He had seen the book before, in the dreams of Genevieve's mother, Marguerite. It was a book of infinite power, a book Marguerite feared and revered in equal measure. One she hid from her husband and her daughters. A book she would never have allowed into the hands of a dark caster or an incubus. A book that could save Ravenwood. Ivy scooped something from inside the folds of her skirt and rubbed it across the face of the book. The white crystals rolled down over the edges. Salt. The weapon of superstitious island women, who brought their own brand of power with them from the Sugar Islands, where their ancestors were born. They believed it warded off demons, a belief that had always amused Abraham.
"I'll come for it, soon as I can, I swear."
"I will keep it safe. You have my word." Abraham brushed some of the salt from the book's cover so he could feel its heat against his skin. He turned back toward the woods. He would walk a few yards for Ivy's benefit. It always scared the Gullah women, to see him travel, to be reminded of what he was.
Put it away, Mr. Ravenwood. Whatever you do, don't open it. That book brings nothing but misery to anyone who messes with it. Don't listen to it when it calls you. I'll come for it.
But Ivy's warning had come too late. Abraham was already listening.
When I came to, I was lying on my back on the floor, staring at my ceiling. It was painted sky blue, like all the ceilings in our house, to fool the carpenter bees that nested there. I sat up, dizzy. The box was beside me, the lid shut. I opened it and the pages were inside. This time I didn't touch them. None of this made sense. Why was I having visions again? Why was I seeing Abraham Ravenwood, a man who folks in town had been suspicious of for generations because Ravenwood was the only plantation to survive the Great Burning? Not that I believed much of anything the folks in town had to say. But when Genevieve's locket triggered the visions, there had been a reason. Something Lena and I needed to figure out. What did Abraham Ravenwood have to do with us? The common thread was the Book of Moons. It was in the locket visions and in this one. But the book was gone. The last time anyone had seen it was the night of Lena's birthday, when it was lying on the table in the crypt, surrounded by fire. Like so many things, it was nothing but ashes now.
May 19th. All That Remains. When I went to school the next day, I sat alone with Link and his four sloppy joes at the lunch table. While I ate my pizza, all I could think about was what Link said about Lena. He was right. She had changed. A little bit at a time, until I almost couldn't remember how things used to be. If I had anyone to talk to about it, I knew they would say to give her time. I also knew that was just something people said when there was nothing left to say and nothing you could do. Lena wasn't coming out of it. She wasn't coming back to herself or to me. If anything, she was drifting farther away from me than anyone else. More and more, I couldn't reach her, not on the inside, not with kelting or kissing or any of the other complicated or uncomplicated ways we used to touch. Now when I took her hand, all I could feel was the chill. And when Emily Asher looked at me from across the lunchroom, there wasn't anything left but pity in her eyes. Once again, I was someone to feel sorry for. I wasn't Ethan Waite, whose mama died just last year. Now I was Ethan Waite, whose girlfriend went psycho when her uncle died. People knew there were complications, and they knew they hadn't seen Lena in school with me. Even if they didn't like Lena, the miserable love to watch someone else's misery. I had just about cornered the market on miserable. I was worse than miserable, lower than a flattened, sloppy Joe left behind on a lunchroom tray. I was alone. One morning, about a week later, I kept hearing a strange sound, like a grating or a record scratching or a page tearing in the back of my mind. I was in history class, and we were talking about the Reconstruction, which was the even more boring time after the Civil War, when the United States had to put itself back together. In a Gatlin classroom, this chapter was even more embarrassing than it was depressing. A reminder South Carolina had been a slave state and that we had been on the wrong side of right. We all knew it, but our ancestors had left us with a permanent F on the nation's moral report card. Cuts that run that deep leave scars, no matter what you try to do to heal them. Mr. Lee was still droning on, punctuating each sentence with a dramatic sigh. I was trying not to listen, when I smelled something burning. Maybe an overheating engine or a lighter. I looked around the room. It wasn't coming from Mr. Lee, the most frequent source of any horrible smell in my history class. no one else seemed to notice it. The noise grew louder into a confusing blur of crashing, ripping, talking, yelling.
Lena? El?
No answer. Above the noise, I heard Lena mumbling lines of poetry, and not the kind you send someone for Valentine's Day.
Not waving, but drowning.
I recognized the poem, and it wasn't good. Lena reading Stevie Smith was only one step up from the darkest Sylvia Plath and the Bell Jar kind of day. It was Lena's red flag, like Link listening to the Dead Kennedys or Amma chopping vegetables for spring rolls with her cleaver.
Hang on, El. I'm coming.
Something had changed, and before it could change back, I grabbed my books and took off running. I was out of the room before Mr. Lee's next sigh. Reese wouldn't look at me when I walked through the door. She pointed to the stairs. Ryan, Lena's youngest cousin, was sitting on the bottom step with Boo, looking sad. When I tousled her hair, she held her fingers to her lips.
Lena's having a nerve breakup. We're supposed to be quiet until Grandma and Mama get home.
That was an understatement. The door was open a crack, and when I pushed on it, the hinges creaked like I was walking into a crime scene. It looked like the room had been tossed. The furniture was upside down or busted up or missing altogether. The entire room was covered with pages of books, pages torn and ripped and plastered all along the walls and ceiling and floor. Not a book was left on the shelf. It looked like a library had exploded. Some of the charred pages piled on the floor were still smoking. The only thing I didn't see was Lena.
El, where are you?
I scanned the room. The wall over her bed wasn't covered with the remnants of the books Lena loved. It was covered in something else. Nobody the dead man and nobody the living. Nobody is giving in and nobody is giving. Nobody hears me, but just nobody cares. Nobody fears me, but nobody just stares. Nobody belongs to me and nobody remains. No nobody knows nothing. All that remains are remains. Nobody and nobody. One of them was Macon, right? The dead man. Who was the other? Me? Was that who I was now? Nobody? Did all guys have to work this hard to figure out their girlfriends? Untwisting the twisted poems written all over their walls in Sharpie or cracked plaster? All that remains are remains. I touched the wall, smearing away the word remains. Because all that remained was not remains. There had to be more than that. More to Lena and me. More to everything. It wasn't just Macon. My mom was gone, but as the last few months had shown, some part of her was with me. I had been thinking about her more and more. Claim yourself. It had been my mom's message to Lena, written in the page numbers of books scattered across the floor of her favorite room at Waits Landing. Her message to me didn't have to be written anywhere, not in numbers or letters or even dreams. Lena's floor looked a little like the study that day, books lying open all over the place, except these books were missing their pages, which sent a different message altogether. Pain and guilt. It was the second chapter of every book my Aunt Caroline had given me about the five stages of grief, or however many stages of grief people say there are. Lena had covered shock and denial, the first two, so I should have seen this one coming. For her, I guess it meant giving up one of the things you loved the most. Books. At least, I hoped that's what it meant. I stepped carefully around the empty, burnt book jackets. I heard the muffled sobs before I saw her. I opened the closet door. She was huddled in the darkness, hugging her knees to her chest.
It's okay, Elle.
She looked up at me, but I wasn't sure what she was seeing. My books all sounded like him. I couldn't make them stop.
It doesn't matter. Everything's okay now.
I knew things wouldn't stay that way for long. Nothing was okay. Somewhere along the way between angry and scared and miserable, she had turned a corner. I knew from experience there was no turning back.
Grandma had finally intervened. Lena would be going back to school next week, like it or not. Her choice was school or the thing nobody said out loud, Blue Horizons or whatever the caster equivalent was. Until then, I was only allowed to see her when I dropped off her homework. I trudged all the way up to her house with a stop-and-steal bag's worth of meaningless worksheets and essay questions.
Why me? What did I do? I guess I'm not supposed to be around anyone who gets me worked up. That's what Reese said.
I'm what gets you worked up? I could feel something like a smile tugging at the back of my mind.
Of course you are. Just not the way they think.
When her bedroom door finally swung open, I dropped the sack and pulled her into my arms. It had only been a few days since I'd seen her in person, but I missed the smell of her hair, the lemons and rosemary, the familiar things. Today I couldn't smell it, though. I buried my face in her neck.
I missed you, too.
Lena looked up at me. She was wearing a black t-shirt and black tights, cut into all kinds of crazy slits up and down her legs. Her hair was squirming loose from the clasp at the back of her neck. Her necklace hung down, twisting on its chain. Her eyes were ringed with darkness that wasn't makeup. I was worried. But when I looked past her to her bedroom, I was even more worried. Grandma had gotten her way. There was not a burnt book, not a thing out of place in the room. That was the problem. There wasn't one streak of Sharpie, not a poem, not a page anywhere in the room. Instead, the walls were covered with images, taped carefully in a row along the perimeter, as if they were some kind of fence trapping her inside. Sacred, sleeping, beloved, daughter. They were photographs of headstones, taken so close that all I could make out was the rough stubble of the rock behind the chiseled words, and the words themselves. Father, joy, despair, eternal rest.
I didn't know you were into photography.
I wondered what else I didn't know.
I'm not, really.
She looked embarrassed.
They're great.
It's supposed to be good for me. I have to prove to everyone that I know he's really gone.
Yeah, my dad's supposed to keep a feelings journal now.
As soon as I said it, I wished I could take it back. Comparing Lena to my dad couldn't be mistaken for a compliment, but she didn't seem to notice. I wondered how long she had been climbing around his garden of perpetual peace with her camera, and how I had missed it. Soldier, sleeping, through a glass darkly. I came to the last picture, the only one that didn't seem to belong with the rest. It was a motorcycle, a Harley leaning against a gravestone. The shiny chrome of the bike looked out of place next to the worn old stones. My heart started to pound as I looked at it.
What's this one?
Lena dismissed it with a wave. Some guy visiting a grave, I guess. He was just kind of there. I keep meaning to take it down. The lighting's terrible. She reached up past me, pulling the tacks out of the wall. When she reached the last one, the photo vanished, leaving nothing but four tiny holes in her black wall. Aside from the images, the room was nearly empty, as if she'd packed up and gone to college somewhere. The bed was gone, the bookshelf and all the books were gone, the old chandelier we'd made swing so many times I had thought it would fall from the ceiling was gone. There was a futon on the floor in the center of the room. Next to it was the tiny silver sparrow. Seeing it flooded my brain with memories from the funeral. Magnolias ripping out of the lawn, the same silver sparrow in her muddy palm. Everything looks so different. I tried not to think about the sparrow or the reason it would be next to her bed, the reason that had nothing to do with Macon. Well, you know, spring cleaning. I had kind of trashed the place. A few tattered books lay on the futon. Without thinking, I flipped one open until I realized I'd committed the worst of crimes. Though the outside was covered with an old, taped-up cover from a copy of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the inside wasn't a book at all. It was one of Lena's spiral notebooks, and I had opened it up right in front of her. Like it was nothing, or it was mine to read. I realized something else. Most of the pages were blank. The shock was almost as terrible as discovering the pages of my dad's gibberish when I had thought he was writing a novel. Lena carried a notebook around with her wherever she went. If she had stopped scribbling every fifth word into it, things were worse than I thought. She was worse than I thought. Ethan, what are you doing? I pulled my hand away and Lena grabbed the book. I'm sorry, Elle. She was furious. I thought it was just a book. I mean, it looks like a book. I didn't think you would leave your notebook lying around where anyone could read it. She wouldn't look at me, clutching the book to her chest. Why aren't you writing anymore? I thought you loved to write. She rolled her eyes and opened the notebook to show me. I do. She fluttered the blank pages, and now they were covered with line upon line of tiny scribbled words, crossed out again and again, revised and rewritten and revisited 1,000 times. You charmed it? I shifted the words out of mortal reality. Unless I choose to show them to someone, only a caster can read them. That's brilliant. Since Rhys, the person most likely to read it, happens to be one. Rhys was as nosy as she was bossy. She doesn't need to. She can read everything in my face. It was true. As a sibyl, Rhys could see your thoughts and secrets, even things you were planning to do, just by looking you in the eye, which was why I generally avoided her. So what's with all the secrecy? I flopped down on Lena's futon. She sat next to me, balancing on her crisscrossed legs. Things were less comfortable than I was pretending they were. I don't know. I still feel like writing all the time. Maybe I just feel less like being understood, or less like I can be. My jaw tightened. By me. That's not what I meant. What other mortals would be reading your notebook? You don't understand. I think I do. Some of it, maybe. I would understand all of it if you'd let me. There's no letting, Ethan. I can't explain it. Let me see it. I held out my hand for her notebook. She raised an eyebrow, handing it to me. You won't be able to read it. I opened it and looked at it. I didn't know if it was Lena or the book itself, but the words appeared on the page in front of me, slowly, one at a time. It wasn't one of Lena's poems, and it wasn't song lyrics. There weren't many words, just strange drawings, shapes and swirls, snaking up and down the page like some collection of tribal designs. At the bottom of the page, there was a list. What I remember. Mother. Ethan. Macon. Hunting. The fire. The wind. The rain. The crypt. The me who is not me. The me who would kill. Two bodies. The rain. The book. The ring. Amma's charm, the moon. Lena grabbed the book out of my hand. There were a few more lines on the page, but I never got to read them.
Stop it.